Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, an hour with a philosopher who has studied Plato and Socrates may provide more insight into why you can't get along with a boss or spouse or yourself than an hour with a shrink and a dose of Prozac, say the newest would-be members of the helping professions, philosophical counselors. Tonight on Point, Socrates versus Sigmund Freud and the growing and controversial field of philosophical counseling. But first, the Arabic satellite channel Al Jazeera has broadcast a 7-minute excerpt of a tape it received today, allegedly made by Al-Qaeda's second-in-command, Ayman al-Zawahiri. In the tape, the speaker refers to Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf as an Islamic traitor and calls for a military uprising in Pakistan. The tape comes as Pakistani troops are in the second week of a campaign along the Afghan border, where the Pakistani president recently suggested a prominent al-Qaeda leader, possibly al-Zawahiri himself, might be hiding. Josh Meyer covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times and joins us from Washington. Good evening and welcome, Josh.
Hi.
Josh, it was just, something like a week ago you and I were talking. We had this news from Islamabad, Pakistan officials saying that there was a quote-unquote high-value target, a phrase I don't know if I'm comfortable with exactly, but right. A high-value target trapped up against the border. That there was talk that it was this very man. Now we've got a tape being played on Al Jazeera. You expressed some skepticism a week ago that, in fact, he would even be there at all. Does this tape mean that he's not surrounded, that this number two man is on the loose?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of different factors here. I was always very skeptical that they'd cornered Zawahiri. As they said, first of all, you can't really corner anybody in that part of the world. They can easily escape through tunnels underground or through the mountains. Two, it was based on Pakistani intelligence, which is not reliable at all and is frequently wrong about things like this. And three, we're not really sure what's going on over there. Some parts of the Pakistani government, even the military, in the past have been somewhat sympathetic to al-Qaeda operatives. It's also true that even if this tape is authentic and the voice sounds like his, Ayman al-Zawahiri could have made the tape before his before the attacks against this al-Qaeda hideout up there, or it could have been made 6 months ago. They do believe, however, preliminary indications are that it does seem to be authentic and fairly recent. So
then a couple lines of questioning present themselves. First of all, are Pakistani troops still surrounding this compound or area that they had first surrounded a week or 10 days ago and where there's been rather intense fighting? Is that standoff still going on?
It's still a standoff. I don't know if they've surrounded them, but they've captured or killed several dozen of these guys. Some of them appear to be Chechen fighters, which would be foreign fighters, but maybe not, surrounding Zawahiri. So I think that still goes on, but I think that there are some people in the U.S. government that are now acknowledging that all along there's a chance that Zawahiri might never have been there, or that if he was, he escaped. I think they found a tunnel underground that's about a mile long that would enable them to pop up almost anywhere.
That is a long tunnel. Then, yeah. On the other hand, what about the line that is being taken in this tape, that Pakistani President Musharraf is a traitor to Islam, calling for an uprising by Pakistan's military? Is this a new kind of call, or has this been a drumbeat for years from al-Qaeda to Pakistan?
Well, I've been reading these transcripts of these tapes for a couple of years now, and it's interesting to watch the evolution of them. They do change. I mean, in this case, Zawahiri or whoever's doing the tape, is almost like a political organizer. I mean, he's calling on Pakistanis to overthrow the government, essentially, telling them that Musharraf is a traitor to the cause. He's stabbing the Islamic resistance in Afghanistan and in Pakistan in the back. And he also, in a very interesting note, called on the Pakistan army, saying that they should uprise again or uprise as well. Mm-hmm. And in one very interesting aside, he talks about how the U.S. government has helped remove Pakistan's nuclear weapons and references the case of Dr. A.Q. Khan, who was the founder of Pakistan's nuclear program, who is in big trouble now for selling nuclear technology in the black market.
Do you have any sense of how officials in Washington are receiving the message in this tape? Colin Powell was just in Pakistan offering a very warm embrace of President Musharraf there. Is there fear that he is, in fact, vulnerable to this kind of political organizing, as you say, on the part of al-Qaeda and Islamist extremists?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think they've been very, very frightened about Musharraf's very fragile hold on power for months now, especially since Pakistan is one of the few countries with nuclear weapons. I mean, he's survived two very close assassination attempts. There's many Islamist parties in the country, political parties, that are quickly sort of taking power in big chunks of the country. And a lot of these groups, there's a religious coalition of these groups that is very sympathetic to al-Qaeda and to the Taliban. And, you know, efforts to reject any efforts by the United States to, you know, have any kind of influence over Pakistan and its nuclear program and its army.
So there's this general concern, but is there that you can pick up an imminent concern of a threat to Musharraf, or is this a kind of longstanding chronic problem that he's facing?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, if he, you know, is assassinated, it would only take, you know, I mean, it, you know, you go from 1 minute him having a hold on power and maybe trying to restore the country to some sense of stability. I mean, if he is assassinated, you know, that would change in a heartbeat, literally. We're helping the Pakistan government on several levels in the fight against al-Qaeda people on the borders. I think we're helping beef up security around Musharraf, and I think we're doing a lot of things behind the scenes to make sure that that doesn't happen, that he stays in power because he's seen as the one, you know, real, you know, stabilizing force in the government.
And not to take it too far, Josh, but just it does raise the question, if instability should hit Pakistan, and of course there have been assassination attempts, multiple attempts, right, just in the past few months, what is the state of security that does or would surround Pakistan's nuclear weapons?
Well, there's some speculation, and I'm told by government officials that it's more than informed speculation, that there's what we call contingency plans in place. Nobody ever wants to talk about those, but I think that there's speculation that the government, the U.S. government, and perhaps even the Israelis and other countries might go in there and try to, take the nukes or stabilize them in some way. I think what we're saying now is that we're working with the Pakistan government to make sure that they're stabilized.
Well, for tonight, a tape and no more, but a disturbing message. Josh Meyer, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Josh Meyer covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. So you're depressed, uneasy, afraid you're losing it. A new challenge to therapy and pills says philosophical counseling might help. Fortune 500 companies are paying $30,000 an hour for philosophers to distill Socrates and Spinoza for their employees. One guru's popular book, Plato Not Prozac, was an international bestseller. Philosophical counseling is hot. Some who sing its virtues want to see it made a licensed profession for addressing mental health. Critics wonder if philosophers have any business treating real-world mental health problems outside of Plato's cave. Tonight on Point, philosophical counseling as an alternative to psychotherapy and pills. Are modern humans uneasy in their minds because they are untutored in philosophy? Could a good dose of philosophical counseling cure your blues, your psychosis? Does philosophical counseling make sense to you? Are psychologists and psychiatrists missing something? Or does this sound like a wrong turn? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Monroe, New York, is Lou Marinoff, professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. He is founding president of the American Philosophical Practitioners Association and author of the best-selling book, Plato Not Prozac, Applying Eternal Wisdom to Everyday Problems. Good evening and welcome, Lou Marinoff.
Good evening, Tom. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Lou Marinoff, what is philosophical counseling?
Well, I think you've described it pretty well already. It's a way in which people can dialogue with philosophers about certain kinds of problems. I must tell you off the top that we're not trying to supplant psychiatry or psychology at all. Philosophy in the ancient world was a guide to the art of living, and we're bringing that back into contemporary times. and applying great ideas to situations where they're appropriate.
Well, you say not trying to supplant psychiatry or psychology, but you're looking for a status where you could actually be turned to and paid by HMOs, let's say, for treating people with mental health issues. That in a way, is kind of de facto supplanting, isn't it?
No, I don't think so at all. In fact, philosophy is for people who are already sane and rational and functional. I don't treat people who are mentally ill because I don't diagnose them, and I'm not trying to do that. But do you realize that people who are perfectly well and rational people, functional people, still have moral dilemmas or career issues or existential crises in their lives or are asking all kinds of philosophical questions themselves? We can help get them in touch with some great ideas that can help. This is therapy for the sane.
Therapy for the sane. Of course, there are a lot of people on this side of insanity, on the near side of insanity, who currently use therapy or perhaps, you know, Prozac or Paxil. You're saying not Prozac, Plato.
So, well, in some cases, Tom, you know, Plato and Prozac, or Prozac first and Plato later. I mean, if you have some serious problem with your brain chemistry, if that's really true,
yeah,
then of course you should go and try and get stabilized. But after that, there's hopefully still room for some dialogue in your life and for some philosophical inquiry. If you have a moral dilemma, Tom, and I'm sure, I hope, you know, you've had and resolved some.
Can't avoid them.
Ethical animals as well as other things. So if you have a moral dilemma, are you going to go see a lawyer or a social worker or a psychologist or a psychiatrist? No. You're going to see someone who's trained and experienced at addressing moral issues. That would be a philosopher.
Lou Marinoff, do you have the sense that that many people today are missing the kind of philosophical training or study or insight that would help them deal with life, and that's leaving people at loose ends, leaving people even uneasy in their mind, in their psyche?
I believe so, and I think it's partly owing to the successes of science and technology in the last 100 or 2 years that people have come, especially in America, to expect a quick fix for every kind of problem. But you know perfectly well, I hope, and so do your listeners, that you can't find the meaning of life or the value or the purpose necessarily of what you're doing in a pill bottle. So we also need to return to philosophy as a way of examining these kinds of issues.
So give us a sense of how that would work. I mean, do you prescribe, you know, 8 hours of Kant twice a week for 3 weeks?
And... No, and I don't say, no, take 2 aphorisms and call me in the morning.
Wow,
I don't
wow.
do that either. There are all kinds of methodologies. We probably don't have time to get into those too deeply. But there are, you know, I can give you a quick case study, if you like. A journalist, as a matter of fact, had put up a painting in his office wall of Gauguin. One of the Tahitian series, and he was compelled to take it down because of an ordinance in the company, a policy. Some other employee took offense at this painting. So he was very upset because he thought he should be free to decorate his office walls as he saw fit.
All right.
But this was a tough thing. He was really read the riot act. He was told, take the painting down or you're out of here. So he took the painting down. But he was very upset because he thought that his taste in art should not be subject to corporate policy.
And he couldn't get over it. He couldn't shake it.
No, he couldn't. And he thought that, well, he was offended, you see. He had taken offense.
All right.
And he did not, to his credit, go ballistic. He didn't come back with an automatic rifle and shoot the place up, as a lot of Americans do, unfortunately. Right? That's one of our ways of
responding. All right, yep.
That's inappropriate.
We've seen it.
Certainly, unfortunately, causes huge damage. So you don't retaliate when something like this happens. But he didn't think that he was mentally ill either. Now, I grant you, a psychoanalyst might have had a field day with this guy. Okay, why Gauguin, right?
Yep.
But that's not the issue. The point is, this guy felt that an injustice had been done.
So what's the treatment here, Doctor?
Well, the treatment here was 50 minutes of dialogue. I do 50-minute hours, too, Tom. And in this case, we use John Stuart Mill. And John Stuart Mill wrote a very important essay on liberty. And the nub of it is that the only justifying power that could be exercised against an individual by an authority would be to prevent that person from doing harm to others. So there's no other justification for coercing people. He had not done harm to anyone. So the failure here is a distinction between offense and harm. The system has failed to make this critical distinction. And because someone was offended, they think they're harmed. And because they think they're harmed, the system offers them a remedy. And this turns out to cause more damage.
So philosophy comes into play. Lou Marinoff, you have suggested that HMOs should be prepared to pay for this kind of counseling. Why?
Well, this is the suggestion of Assemblyman Diaz, and I think it's actually a very good one. He recognizes in his constituency, which is the South Bronx, that a lot of people are making essentially uninformed or uncritical life decisions, which sometimes lead them into prison or lead them into, you know, lives of crime and so forth. And perhaps one of the things that could help would be some kind of critical ethical thinking that, you know, if we are free beings in the sense of being able to choose, then we certainly owe it to ourselves to make better choices as opposed to worse ones. This is just one constituency that might be better served by philosophy. Now, who pays for it is really beside the point to me. I do it freely. I do it on research protocols. When I give it away, I also charge clients who can afford. Money is not the number one issue. The issue is we're rendering a service that's alternative and that's important and that's vital. And eventually, if states want to certify us, then obviously we can get reimbursed by third parties.
Well, it's a real head-turner, and you are certainly stirring the pot. Lou Marinoff, thanks very much for being with us tonight, giving us a glimpse of what you're up to.
You're so welcome, Tom. Thanks for the chance to talk about it.
Lou Marinoff, professor of philosophy at City College of New York, author of Plato, Not Prozac. We are talking tonight about the push for philosophy, perhaps as an alternative to psychotherapy. You can join the conversation. Does it make sense to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about philosophical counseling, the push for philosophy, perhaps as an alternative to psychotherapy, maybe Socrates versus Sigmund Freud and Zoloft. You can join our conversation tonight. Does this make sense to you? Could a good dose of philosophy cure your blues, even your psychosis? Are modern humans uneasy in their minds because they are untutored in philosophy? And has traditional psychotherapy missed something fundamental? Does philosophical counseling sound reasonable to you or absurd? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Fort Pierce, Florida by Elliot Cohen. He's co-executive director of the American Society for Philosophy, Counseling, and Psychotherapy. He's director of the Institute of Critical Thinking in Port Lucie, Florida, author of 11 books, including What Would Aristotle Do? Self-Control Through the Power of Reason. Good evening and welcome, Elliot Cohen.
Good to be here, Tom.
And good to have you. Thanks so much for being here. Also with us tonight from Washington is Maura Tumulty. She's assistant professor of philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. She specializes in the philosophy of psychology. It sounds like exactly the bridge we need. Maura Tumulty, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tom. Good evening.
Elliot Cohen, I wish you'd expand for a moment, if you would be good enough, on what's meant by philosophical counseling. We just talked to Lou Marinoff for a minute. I know he's very high profile in this whole field and maybe controversial as well. He may think the same of you, for all I know. But how do you describe, to a layperson who's never heard of it, what philosophical counseling is, what applications it has?
Well, philosophical counseling is pretty much, as it says, philosophical counseling. It's philosophy applied to the psychological areas or psychotherapy. And that's why Lou Marinoff's distinction between philosophical counseling on the one hand and psychotherapy on the other doesn't seem to hold water. Philosophical counseling is applications to mental health of philosophy. And psychotherapies are to some extent philosophical. I mean, existential therapy is philosophical. Rational motor behavior therapy is philosophical. All philosophical theories are, embedded in, many philosophical theories are embedded in the psychotherapeutic approaches. So,
Elliot Cohen, paint a picture for us. Some listeners will have been in therapy, psychotherapy. Some never will have been. I find it hard to imagine the distinctions that you're drawing here, or the difference in approaches. If you were in what has been fairly standard, if that's a fair word, American contemporary approach to therapy, and you shifted to philosophical counseling, give us a sense of the difference. What would the first feel like? What would the second be like?
Well, I think Lou Marinoff is right. If the issue is an ethical problem, I mean, philosophers are certainly in a field of their own. Many cases when we're talking about an ethical problem, the problems that he talks about in his book at the beginning, for instance, whether or not to disconnect somebody from a respirator. These are issues that philosophers come into the scene and do a very good job helping physicians.
That's pretty clear, but I don't think most people who go to therapists are there with ethical crises. More often, it's unease. It's they can't
That's
eat.
Right.
They can't sleep. They have relationships. Their brains are itchy. They feel like they're going out of their gourd. Whatever it might be, what's the difference in how traditional therapy and your counseling would approach that sort of issue?
Well, my counseling actually is an outgrowth of psychotherapy. I'm a student of rational emotive behavior therapy, and I've developed a more philosophical variant, what I call logic-based therapy, which basically rides on many of the distinctions that psychotherapists like Albert Ellis have developed. And so what I do in my approach is to bring in conceptual philosophical distinctions and analysis where there's need and supplement in a way the traditional therapies. So if I can give you an example,
yes, please.
Maybe that would help. Let's say a client comes to me and expresses that he thinks he's a just a worthless screw up. And the question is, the question I'll ask is, why are you thinking that of yourself? And suppose he responds by saying, I screwed up at work. I've been doing that a lot lately. I've missed a meeting. We missed an account that as a result of that.
A thousand reasons,
yeah. And so here's his reasoning. Well, you're a worthless screw up because you screwed up. And the assumption in the reasoning is that anybody who screws up is a worthless screw up. And so the reasoning goes, anyone who screws up is a worthless screw-up. I screwed up, so I'm a worthless screw-up.
Okay, yeah.
Well, it doesn't end there, though. I mean, let's say this person is depressed. Well, then there's likely to be some behavioral manifestations. And if I'm a screw-up, then there's another rule, as I call it, that he's subscribing to, in this case a behavioral rule, which would be something like, well, if I'm a worthless screw-up, then I must act like a worthless screw-up. I have to stay at home, stay in my bedroom, or not go to work, call in sick, stare at the ceiling for hours. And so there's going to be behavioral manifestations.
Okay, so the traditional or sort of standard psychotherapist then talks about the background, their sense of themselves, maybe prescribes an antidepressant. What do you do?
Well, let's take this further. There's at this point, there's behavioral changes, there's cognitive changes, and there's likely then also to be physiological changes going on in the body.
You're digging a pretty deep hole here. It's getting hard for me to see how Plato pulls this guy out.
Okay, well, that's the point. Just Plato alone isn't going to pull him out. And that's one of the things that Marinoff misses, that traditional psychotherapies have spent a good deal of time working on behavioral therapy and assignments in behavioral changes and even medications are sometimes indicated. So, I mean, we can't really bifurcate, and this is my point, the psychotherapeutic approaches and philosophical counseling, they fit inside it. So
I'm still trying to hear what you'd bring to it, though. Are you going to assign him to read a little bit of Schopenhauer and a little bit of, John Stuart Mill?
Here's how it goes, Tom. What happens now is, okay, this person is depressed. Where is the depression? The depression is in the change of cognitions, the change in behavior, the physiological changes going on in the body. What I do is I look at the premises of the client's reasoning. Well, what was one of the premises, if you recall? If I screw up, then I'm a worthless screw-up. What we try to do in logic-based therapy is to show the irrationality of the thinking there. Screwing up doesn't make you a screw-up. Otherwise, everybody would be a screw-up because we all indeed screw up. So you can see the reductio ad absurdum of that. It's an example of a traditional fallacy that logicians call the fallacy of composition.
So you're not citing a particular philosopher or philosophy, but you're using a philosopher's way of thinking.
Exactly.
And then you're relying on this poor, depressed devil's rationality and power of reason then to build him a ladder back out of that hole of depression?
Well, this is true too. I don't believe that every modality in psychotherapy works for everybody, and I don't believe that every modality of philosophical counseling works for everybody either. This individual has to see logical distinctions. They can see that what's true of the part isn't true of the whole. That's not a hard distinction to see. But you're right, and they're still in a hole. And understanding something intellectually doesn't necessarily mean you're going to appreciate it emotionally. So what's likely to happen here is there's going to be some understanding here that, all right, I'm thinking irrationally, but what do I do about it? At this point, what I do is I prescribe or suggest antidotes to the irrational thinking, and pardon my medical jargon. I know Lou doesn't see philosophical counseling on a medical model, but there are
and these antidotes. Do they come in a pill bottle, or are you talking pearls of wisdom?
They don't come in a pill bottle. They come in common sense, and the common sense here is to juxtapose to the irrational line of thinking a more rational line of thinking. So you got two lines of reasoning going on. The second one might be something like, one should learn from one's experiences of making mistakes. This is a learning experience, so I ought to learn. So we have here what's called cognitive dissonance, where you have two sets of reasoning, one vying with the next. And it's here where one has to work on this through exercising one's willpower. One has to work on this by making behavioral changes. For instance, what should this individual do? Well, exert that willpower to get out of bed, push oneself out of bed, to go to work, to go to entertaining functions, and to do other things, and to keep working on it cognitively, that is, realizing this is an irrational mode of thinking, working on it behaviorally. And one can oftentimes get around the medication.
And but maybe here, leaning on the wisdom of philosophy or a philosophical way of thinking, at least, to do that. Merle Tumbley, come in here with us. I'm trying to make sense of where the line falls here between therapy and medication that Americans would be familiar with and what Elliot Cohen's suggesting. Is this a brave new world in your perspective or something else?
It's a cautious new world.
Let me get more on this if you'd be good enough, Elliot.
Right.
I mean, I think I would agree to a fair extent with Elliot that there's a continuum between lines of thinking and lines of reasoning, clarifying concepts that philosophers would recognize as things that we do amongst ourselves and when we educate people about what philosophers have done throughout history, and then the kinds of self-examination that in a therapeutic context your counselor or psychiatrist wants to provoke in you.
Okay.
I think the difference, and I hear Elliot getting at it, but maybe not drawing the distinction as firmly as I myself would prefer.
All right.
Between drawing out sort of lines of thinking that someone might be engaging in that are inappropriate, indicating this to them, giving them alternatives, and perhaps giving them alternatives from the philosophical tradition, all of that to me sounds as if that's pretty firmly within a type of philosophical conversation. But giving someone the techniques to, for example, break out of repetitive patterns of thinking or overcome paralyzing emotions, I think of that as definitely needing to be on a more medical model. And I don't think the fact that someone has a great deal of philosophical training is going to enable them to practice those techniques or recognize when those techniques need to be used.
Now, we talked with Lou Marinoff earlier, but it's interesting to note this, of course, was in the New York Times on Sunday. He's in the middle of a lawsuit. I won't ask you to speak to that here, but a lawsuit with City College in New York. They tried to put a moratorium on his particular counseling, I guess because they're worried, that they've got a student with suicidal tendencies and someone prescribes Heidegger instead of psychiatric information and it doesn't work, they're going to have a mess on their hands. Is this getting out in some kind of shaky territory here, or is this a real important, valuable supplement to the kinds of therapies and medications that are so common today?
I think both, unfortunately. I think part of living a good life and being a healthy person is engaging in a fair amount of self-examination. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes you need to explore that in dialogue and mutuality with someone else. But I also think that people are not always in a good position to recognize what type of help they need. And I think it's still in our culture very difficult for someone, despite the things that people say about, oh, we over-medicalize everything, people are so comfortable taking Prozac. I think it's still very difficult for people to admit that they need to seek psychiatric help. And if someone is holding himself out as a counselor and therefore counting on some level as able to perform mental health interventions but isn't a psychiatrist, that could seem more comfortable comfortable to someone. And then they go for this type of counseling, and the philosophical counselor isn't in a position to make a distinction between whether this is what that person needs or whether, in fact, they need something much more immediate and more medical in its model.
So they might get the Plato, but not the big safety net that they might need at that moment. More tumulty. Elliot Cohen, please stand by just a second. I want to get some callers in here. So many want to join the conversation. Alan is calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Good evening. I'm a regular listener, and this show is refreshing among many refreshing shows. The unexamined life is not worth living. I really can't speak to the counseling end of it, but yeah. I have owned my business for more than 20 years. I have an undergraduate degree in philosophy, a high honors degree in philosophy and history. I use this every day, and I will give you three broad areas where it is invaluable in dealing with human relationships in business.
Let's hear them.
Number one is ethics.
Yeah.
In order to run a good business and to be successful, you must be ethical every minute of the day. And sometimes there is a genuine struggle there to figure out what's the right thing to do.
And we can see that philosophical training definitely helps with that. Where else is it helpful?
There's no question. The second area I would broadly place under epistemology, knowledge. You ask yourself sometimes, what is this person thinking? And if you listen carefully, you can probably figure out where the thinking comes from, and in that manner, engage the person productively.
So a pattern of thought, so you're not just frustrated. You can get to the heart of it. And your final area where it helps?
Well, the final area is clearly systematic thinking. It's logic. I use it every moment because it's an invaluable resource.
But let me ask you this then, Alan. Do you think that this philosophical training has made you more mentally healthy? Has it protected your mental health? If you fell into depression, would you look for philosophical counseling to deal with that?
Well, let me add something to the mix here. You may find this very interesting. I'm a decorated Vietnam veteran.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there. And let me tell you that my training in philosophy has dragged me out of some pretty dark nights. Because ultimately, the true, the good, and the beautiful must prevail. And I suppose you would think that's self-analysis given the context of the current discussion. But I can assure you that the people that and again, this is nothing against the psychiatric profession because Robert J. Lifton also did me a whole lot of good. But let me just say that this show you're having, I would hope that you might repeat this and dig into this more deeply because you're really onto something here, and I want to give someone else a chance to talk.
Thank you for your call. Great to have you. Elliot Cohen, how about it? Here's testimony from a kind of trained philosopher who says it helps him a lot. Are psychotherapy and psychopharmacology missing something important?
Well, I think the last area that was touched on is an important one, and that's that philosophical thinking is logical thinking, and it's really the power of logical, rational thinking that's the forte of philosophers, and that's what philosophy, for the most part, I think, can bring to psychotherapy, where philosophers are trained in this kind of systematic, careful, analytical thinking that psychotherapy normally doesn't have as much training or very little, if any, in that area. I do want to comment, though, on this notion of therapy for the sane that I've been hearing. I think that's dangerous. The reason why
kind
I think...
Lou Marinoff's phrase, I guess.
Well, actually, that phrase was first spoken by Pete March,
okay.
A Canadian colleague of ours. But anyway, I think it's dangerous because what it does is propagate a common stereotype, and that's that if you go to psychotherapy, somehow you're not sane.
We hear that loud and clear, and that's not what we're about tonight, but we are looking at this new field. Elliot Cohen, Maura Tumulty, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the push for philosophy, potentially as an alternative to psychotherapy. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about philosophical counseling, the push for philosophy as an alternative or a supplement, maybe, to psychotherapy. Socrates versus Sigmund Freud and Zoloft. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you imagine, in a moment of psychological crisis, reaching for Schopenhauer or Kant? Does this sound like a dangerous distraction from the real work of psychotherapy and psychopharmacology? Are people unhappy because they're making bad assumptions about life? Could philosophy help? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking with Elliot Cohen. He's co-executive director of the American Society for Philosophy, Counseling, and Psychotherapy. And by Maura Tumulty, joining us from Washington tonight, assistant professor of philosophy at Johns Hopkins University, specializing in the philosophy of psychology. We are joined now from Tenafly, New Jersey, by Charles Goodstein. He's clinical professor of psychiatry, New York University School of Medicine. He's president of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York. Good evening and welcome, Charles Goodstein.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What do you make of this idea, Dr. Goodstein, of philosophers kind of moving in on the edges of the territory that's been the province of psychotherapists?
Well, first let me say that all that I know about this field, I derive from the article in the New York Times.
All right, fair enough.
I know nothing about its methodology. I know nothing about data that might relate to results of these treatments. So I really speak as somebody who's not at all an expert in this area. But I guess I could say a few things I think that are important. First of all, you know that those of us who are involved in clinical work really do welcome any approach that might be of some help to selected individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So in the history of our field, there have been treatment modalities that were once dismissed out of hand and have subsequently been incorporated into the larger practice that we do. However, once I've said that, I should add something else, and that is that there are, I'm not sure, perhaps 400 or so therapies out there.
I mean, different kinds of therapy, different approaches.
Different so-called therapies,
mm-hmm.
certain legitimate therapies, but there are many, many people who claim to be therapists. And maybe some of them accomplish something in some selected areas, so it's very hard to judge this. However, very often treatment results are accomplished not so much because of the power of the underlying theory, but because of the kind of relationship that some therapists are able to form with some patients.
Okay.
To some extent, I'm not certain that they're really treating so much as perhaps persuading.
Are you saying that it doesn't matter whether it's psychology or philosophy? It's all about the relationship or something else?
What I would say is in some selected cases, certain figures, especially some who might be somewhat charismatic,
yes.
might well be able to bring about some changes in some very selected patients. However, once I've said that, I would also add that I think there are many instances in which things go wrong. And I'm a little bit concerned about this approach that I've been hearing about. I've been listening in on the conversation. And I'm concerned about lots of things. First of all, I'm concerned about what I hear as an approach that suggests, first of all, that somehow logic is the province of the philosopher. This is a new one for me.
You're saying psychoanalysts, psychotherapists are going to also work in that realm.
Well, I should hope that there's a logical underpinning to everything that they do. The notion that somehow we're about to surrender logic to the philosopher strikes me as being absurd.
But I have a question just on that point. The notion that we're hearing from Elliot Cohen and others that philosophers, even if they don't have a monopoly on this, they work in logic and reason.
We all do.
Well, is that, do you buy that as a ladder that can pull people out of mental health tight spots?
In fact, that's the next point I was going to make.
Mm-hmm.
For us, for the people who work in a way that I do, my colleagues do, while we very much are in tune with logical difficulties that patients have, we're more interested in many cases in those components of their mental life of which they're not conscious at all.
Yeah.
And if we ignore that aspect of them, well, we think we're really missing an awful lot. The thought that somehow one can exhort and in certain ways persuade people to change by having them see the light, by having them recognize the lack of logic in what they've done, to me seems like a fairly limited approach.
Charles Gustine, if you'd hold it there, Elliot Cohen, how about that? Because I had the same question. Psychiatrists, psychologists deal so much with the unconscious, which seems almost by definition off limits to a philosopher. It's the examined that the philosopher examine or pick up and deal with. So how can you really deal with deep-seated mental health problems if you're not dealing with the unconscious? Does philosophy have access to that?
Well, I think is a good point that's being made. I mean, there are some subconscious, unconscious motivations in some disorders that are salient. But in most common problems that people have, I would say the myriad of them, it's not repressed thoughts really, but it's actually what I call suppressed premises that are causing the problem.
That's interesting. Charles Gustine, what about that view?
Well, I really would dispute that. I think one of the problems that people sometimes have is a lack of awareness of their own unconscious mental life, the lack of recognition of universal unconscious factors, the thought that certain problems have solely conscious determinants, I think is completely incorrect. And I think, therefore, that this approach may work, as I say, with some very limited populations, but I think in many, many instances, people will receive partial, very incomplete help.
Charles Gustine, we appreciate your perspective and your time tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay.
Charles Gustine, president of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York. Madassa is calling from Westwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Madassa. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Tom. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for calling.
Hello to your guests as well. It's an interesting subject. I have probably two points or two comments about that. The first one is philosophy is always dealing with universal truth, which is mostly the case of abstract thinking.
Often, yeah.
And doesn't apply to individual problems. And the other things I have, which probably support of that approach, that mental problem or emotional problem will lead to reasoning destruction. And this is where philosophy, more than psychology, would help better in kind of exploring the logical, the reasoning way of thinking to the person who is facing problem.
But if your very capacity to reason has suffered some destruction, it could make it a difficult path out, couldn't it?
I mean, the capacity of reasoning, if it's affected by a psychological problem, you would need the psychoanalysis to have a very strong background to determine or even bring the patient or the person to the level to understand where is the problem in destroying his or her reasoning.
Yeah, Madassa, we've got it, and thanks so much for your call. And it leads me to ask you, Elliot Cohen, I mean, I remember times, in college, sitting in the middle of the night over Kant, you know, it made me want to shoot myself. It was so difficult to get into. Can philosophy be as confusing as it is instructive?
Well, you know, there's a way of making Kant easy. I know that sounds strange, but, for instance, Kant's categorical imperative to treat persons as or humanity as ends in themselves and not as mere means means you don't objectify people. You treat them with respect. And that's a very important principle because many interpersonal relationships are the result of what I call rules of blackmail and rules of manipulation of various and sundry varieties. But putting a little Kant in there and seeing Kant as an antidote to some of these irrational rules that ultimately cause dysfunctional interpersonal relationships, that can be very useful.
So don't throw the whole book at them, but give them a bit of it. Wayne is calling from West End, Wisconsin. Hi, Wayne. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening for about a half an hour, and I must be very honest. I'm so excited about talking to you people that I can hardly contain myself.
Okay.
Let me premise my remarks by saying I am a 63-year-old white male. I am diagnosed with a legitimate classic bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
My first depression was at 14. I went psychotic at 19. I sincerely concur with these people that the philosopher and the theologian should concur with the people in medical science in treating people with severe mental and emotional disorders.
But Wayne, if you're seriously bipolar, do you think that philosophy can help you out, or do you depend on pharmaceuticals, on medicine at some point to help you with that?
Sir, I had 4 med calls today. I took all of them. And yet, to truly come into my own being and my awareness and my being a member of in society, mm-hmm. I must do more than take my medication. I am an artist and a scholar. I'm artistic and rural, and I consider myself, I read heavily, but I don't read in the psychological sciences because I don't want to analyze myself.
But it sounds like you might be ready to grab onto some philosophy and run with it. Wayne, our time is short, and I apologize, but I'm going to have to let that be it. But we thank you very much for your call. More tumulty. Here's Wayne. He's bipolar, and he knows it. He's excited by the idea of philosophy helping him out. Are you comfortable with him reaching for that as a rung on the ladder to mental health?
I certainly am, because I think that it's part of getting back to a way of thinking about your life as meaningful. That surely is part of getting back to a healthy life. I think the problem, and I know Elliot is not proposing this, the problem mm-hmm. would be in seeing it as a simple substitution. And I also think at the end, when Wayne was talking about being a contributing member of society mm-hmm. and that he has something to contribute as an artist, I think there's the danger about philosophical counseling failing individuals in need, but there's also the danger that philosophical counseling could in a way damage philosophy. Wayne is asking to have a dialogue as an equal with people about the meaning of life.
Yes.
And I think philosophers should participate in that. But philosophy has always been about examining its own biases and mistakes as much as telling other people what to think.
And that's a kind of endless loop that could sort of consume someone, you're saying?
Well, no, I guess what I'm saying is if I'm setting myself up as Wayne's counselor, then I'm not seeing him as a dialogical equal. I'm not open to the possibility that he might tell me that I'm wrong, mm-hmm. that I have some epistemological problems. If I want to have a philosophical conversation with Wayne, then I need to be open to the possibility that he could point out to me mistakes that I'm making. And I think a counseling situation is very different from that. And I worry about this self-critical aspect that good philosophy always involves getting lost in the type of persuasion that counseling always has to involve.
It seems just the kind of point that a philosopher would take us to. Elliot Cohen, our time is, and a good one, our time is very short. Are you in the same school as Lou Marinoff? Would you like to see HMOs reimbursing philosophical counselors for their guidance to patients?
Well, unless he can adequately distinguish between philosophical counseling and psychotherapy in such a way that he draws a clear line. I mean, he might be able to certify ethicists, but certainly there's plenty of ethicists out there already who are working functionally within various institutions. I don't really see this happening until there's a clear delineation. I think that philosophers can help and work together with psychotherapists, and that's what we're doing
And that's where you would point. With that, we've got to go, and I'm sorry for that, Elliot, but we are out of time. Elliot Cohen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Maura Tumulty at Johns Hopkins, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Listeners, we will end this hour with some readings from the great philosophers. We hope they will help you think through your life's challenges.
Charles de Montesquieu. There is no one, says another, whom fortune does not visit once in his life. But when she does not find him ready to receive her, she walks in at the door and flies out at the window.
Confucius. What the superior man seeks is in himself. What the mean man seeks is in others.
Benedict Spinoza. Men are deceived if they think themselves free. An opinion which consists only in this, that they are conscious of their actions and ignorant of the causes by which they are determined.
David Hume. Beauty in things exists in the mind which contemplates them.
Jean-Paul Sartre. Consciousness is a being, the nature of which is to be conscious of the nothingness of its being.
Socrates. To fear death, my friends, is only to think ourselves wise without being wise, for it is to think that we know what we do not know. For anything that men can tell, death might be the greatest good that can happen to them. but they fear it as if they know quite well that it was the greatest of evils. And what is this but that shameful ignorance of thinking that we know what we do not know?
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Support.